It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Yesterday on Wall Street, the Dow dropped 1,089 points. That is the largest point loss ever during a trading day. While some of that loss was made up, it did little to ease the fears of investors and others. Why is this happening, and what impact could it have on the Pittsburgh region? I'm joined now by phone by Jay Sukits, professor of business administration at the University of Pittsburgh's Katz Graduate School of Business. Jay Sukits, good to have you back with us.
Yes, good afternoon, Paul. How are you?
Well, thank you. If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh at wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. What worries you about all this market volatility? What questions do you have? There are probably plenty of things that you don't understand about what factors into it. Certainly, I'll admit that there's a lot I don't understand as well. 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's why you're with us, Jay Sukits. And before we zoom in on our region and how all of this could impact us here in Western Pennsylvania, let's look at why this is happening. What has caused the market to fluctuate so wildly?
Well, there's a number of factors. If I could boil them all down to one word, I might say fear. Fear is probably the one word to boil them down to. You know, we like to think in terms of finance theories and the concepts of economics, et cetera, that the market acts rationally all the time, that investors make rational decisions about value. I can tell you from having worked on Wall Street for over 22 years, much of what drives the prices on the market and the activities of people like traders is fear and greed. And I think what's been happening here are surprises that have occurred over the last few weeks that have prompted a sell-off of what I really think are not investors. I don't really think you're seeing investors just sort of say, well, I want to bail on my investments. I think what you're seeing here are traders driven by, especially by algorithmic trading techniques, that is computerized trading techniques, selling based on what I think they perceive as changes in values in other markets, especially in emerging markets, that is smaller countries. And then at the top of the list is this constant litany about China. You know, I think if one thing, I don't want to accuse the news media of stirring up fear, although it every time you look at, let's say, something like a finance page on the internet or the headlines on a newspaper, the first thing you see in the morning is China's stock market is down 7% or something like that. Now, the interesting thing, and my guess is people read that and they think, oh my goodness, what's happening in China? The interesting thing about that is the Chinese stock market is so small. It's such a tiny market. Just to put that in perspective, the United States stock market, if you look at its entire market value, is $19 trillion. The entire Chinese stock market, the whole market, is $8 billion, or $800 billion. It's about 4% of what our market is. The sell-off that occurred in our markets yesterday, that entire sell-off in one day was as much as the entire Chinese stock market is valued at. And so I think the idea that somehow the Chinese stock market is problematic for our markets is way overblown. I think it represents more of a fear on the part of traders, and I think on the part of some investors also, that the representation there is that there's problems in the Chinese economy, which is the third largest economy in the world.
And that leads to a question that a lot of people have. Are the U.S. and Chinese economies coupled or linked in some way? And if so, how is that? You know, what is the significant impact? Maybe it's not so much about what happens on the Chinese stock market, but if the Chinese economy is adversely affected, that, most people would assume, impacts our economy and ultimately our market activity, right?
Well, I would argue that there's positives in the linkage between the United States and China. As an example, if you take our entire GDP, our entire gross domestic product, only about 1% of it our exports to China. And so, you know, the thought is that there's this huge Chinese market of a billion consumers, and they're going to buy every Apple Watch that's produced. The fact is, only about 1% of our entire gross domestic product are exports. The bigger part of our linkage to China are imports that we, you can walk into any store, Walmart, Target, whatever, and you can see virtually hundreds of products that say made in China on them. And what's interesting is that the Chinese central bank just devalued their currency about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago. They devalued the yuan for the first time, I believe, in 5 years. And in fact, they've never purposely devalued the yuan that I can remember. Now, what that does is it makes Chinese products cheaper, which for a United States consumer, a purchaser of those products here in the United States, that's good for us because it makes those products cheaper.
Well, it's good for the consumers, but I don't think the Obama administration likes it very much, or the government.
Well, I don't, you know, the Obama administration doesn't like it because the Obama administration and the government would like to see the yuan actually stronger, because there's a thought that if the yuan is stronger, then Chinese consumers can start buying more U.S. products so that our exports will be more favorable to the Chinese market. So you can kind of make a case for both of those things. My suggestion would be, though, if you look at the differentials between the imports and exports, we have a trade deficit versus China. We do import more things than we export to them. And I think when you look at an economy, our economy is driven by about 70% of our economy is driven by consumption, by consumer purchases. And so when you get cheaper consumer products, that's good for us. It's good for our consumers. And, you know, the third thing about the Chinese economy as it's linked to the United States is the amount of U.S. debt that China owns.
Right.
There's approximately $15 trillion or so. There's, you know, the U.S. total debt is actually, the U.S. total debt is about $19 trillion right now. But about $5 to $6 trillion of that is intergovernmental debt. So it's not really government, it's not U.S. Treasury bills, notes, or bonds that's actually out there in the market. So you've got about $13 trillion or so notes, bills, and bonds that are out in the market. China owns about 11% of that, or about $1.4 trillion. With what's happened in the market, the Treasury market has actually rallied. Interest rates have gone down, and prices on Treasury securities have gone up. That's actually helped the owners of those securities in China. That's actually made their bond portfolios that they own of United States securities actually more valuable. So, you know, when you look at the different linkages, I think what's going on in China, and by the way, China overnight lowered their base interest rate by 25 basis points. They also lowered their reserve requirements on bank lending. So, in fact, what they did on a de facto basis on those two things is they've expanded credit and they've expanded liquidity in their economy, and that's going to help them. That can only help them. And I think what we need to do here is kind of look at what China's doing. China kind of plays the long game. They're looking in the long run as to how this is going to affect their economy. And so I think we need to look at that also. I don't think that you can look at a couple of things in the short run and say, well, you know, China's going down the tubes. I think eventually China will be okay. I think it's still okay right now. And our linkages to China are important, but I think they're a little overblown by both perception and by what comes out of the news.
We're talking with Jay Sukitz, who is professor of business administration at the University of Pittsburgh's Katz Graduate School of Business here on Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we'll take your calls now at 412-246-2002. Let's start with Dorian from Kennedy Township. Dorian, welcome.
Yeah.
Go ahead with your comment or question.
My question is for Jay. When the algorithms kicked in and took over for the 1,000-point drop, who profited?
Well, I don't, you know, it's pretty clear that there's one of two things going on. There are traders that are profiting from that. And a lot of those traders classify themselves as hedge funds. There may very well be people who were long and were losing money because of that as well. So you don't really know. These are not traders that have to report their results publicly like mutual funds do. So mutual funds are all required to report what they own and what their performance is publicly. Most of these traders, the proprietary traders on Wall Street and the hedge fund traders and the long-short traders that use algorithmic trading techniques, they don't have to report. So you don't really know. So it could be as many people are losing money as are making money.
Jay, how is the market doing today? What is happening? I'm sure you're following it.
Well, the last time I checked, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 340 points. This is the largest one-day up move of 2015. We had the largest one-day down move yesterday.
Right.
I think this is in reaction to the credit moves that China has made. The European markets, by the way, all the European, that in a 24-hour cycle, if you start on a Sunday night, the Asian markets trade first, then the European markets, and then our markets. And so overnight, the European markets were up huge. The DAX 30, the CAC 40, the London Financial Times 100, they were all up 3.5% to 4%, all in reaction, I think, to this credit move that China made in expanding liquidity in the economy.
412-246-2002, if you would like to join our conversation with Jay Sukits of the University of Pittsburgh's Katz School, Graduate School of Business. Let's go to Rick in Pittsburgh with a question. Rick, welcome. Hi, Rick. Rick, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I thought it was. Yeah, my question is, in the 70s, we had stagflation. I believe one of the causes of that was oil creating cost push inflation. So the price of high price of oil was a bad thing. How wonderful it would have been if the price of oil would have gone down. Now in 2015, we have wonderfully priced oil, and we have a problem. I can guess at the answer to that, but I'd like to hear an opinion.
Well, I have to tell you, Rick, I say that to myself all the time. I think that's a great question because I actually worked on Wall Street in the 70s, in the mid to late 70s. And then I think back to, I guess it was June or July of 08, when oil was $147 a barrel. And every time oil went up a dollar a barrel, you could actually see the stock market go down about 65 cents on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It was that kind of linkage. So high oil prices were really bad for the market. And now you look and you see every time oil goes down, the market goes down. So now low oil prices are bad for the market.
And why is that?
Well, the fact is, what you have two different dynamics going on. Back in 08, and even back in the 70s, we were still importing huge amounts of oil. And so every time prices would go up, all it meant was we're going to pump more dollars overseas. And we're spending more and more for higher-priced oil. You know, we've turned this around so much in the last 5 to 6 years. We are now the leading producer of oil and natural gas in the world. When you combine those two commodities, we are the leading producer of crude oil and natural gas. And so what's happened is now as prices go down, what you're seeing is all of these companies, and you can kind of name them, you know, that it's Range Resources, it's Chesapeake Energy, it's Delaware Energy. You can name all of them. As the prices for these commodities go down lower and lower and lower, they are making less and less money on both their exploration, their drilling, their pumping, and their transportation. And the problem with that is, as it's perceived at least by the stock market and by, you know, economists, is you're going to see some of these companies go bankrupt. You're going to see some of these companies, and they've been doing this, laying off a lot of oil field workers and gas field workers. So there's two different dynamics. If you're importing, like we were in the 70s, we were importing enormous amounts of crude oil. And even in 08, we were importing a huge amount. So high prices are really bad for you. But now if you're a producer, and you're one of the biggest producers in the world, the low prices are very bad. But, because that means companies start to shut down.
But doesn't it cut both ways? Because if gas prices are lower, then consumers have more money in their pockets and therefore more discretionary dollars, right? They can maybe spend that money on other things to help the economy.
Yeah. I agree with that 100%. I think, you know, the fact that consumers can spend they spend fewer dollars on crude oil or on gasoline or on heating oil or on natural gas, and by the way, also that they're spending fewer dollars on, as I mentioned before, on importing of Chinese consumer goods, those are really good things. And I think the fact is, what you haven't seen yet, though, I don't know that you've seen those things kick in as much as they normally would have in an economy that did not go through the kind of crisis we went through in 08 and 09. Normally, those kinds of things, where you have much lower prices, and so you have more discretionary income, it usually would have consumers spending a heck of a lot more money. But I think the thought is that what people have been doing for the last 7-8 years is putting more and more money away in savings, because people got burned pretty badly, obviously, in the Great Recession. It's very interesting that if you look at the economic statistics that have come out lately, we got some great statistics. We've been getting really good statistics. We got some really good statistics this morning about the housing market. The housing market appears really strong. And another statistic that just came out, which was, I think, surprised everybody, was consumer confidence was extremely strong right now. And I think what you just said, Paul, about low oil prices, I think that's part of it. Lower gasoline prices, consumer confidence. I believe, as I saw the number, just hit like a five-year high when the number came out. I think it came out at 10 o'clock this morning.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest, Jay Sukits, in the few minutes that we have left. Let's go to Ted in Mount Washington with a question. Ted, hi. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, real quick, two things. When will China's real estate bubble pop? Because there's a lot of bad loans by their central bank. And also, what is the future of American manufacturing? Thank you.
Thanks, Ted.
Well, I would, as they used to say on the old quiz shows, I'll take the second question first. You know, it's funny because when you hear people talk about manufacturing, a lot of the politicians, all, you know, they'll say things like, we have to bring manufacturing back to the United States, or manufacturing is gone. And I guess these are things that stir people up. When you really start looking at the hard data, what's very interesting is if you look at the amount of products that were manufactured in the United States in 1980, and then look at the amount of manufacturing we have today, we're manufacturing about 54% more stuff now than we were in 1980. We're a huge producer, obviously, of things like jet aircraft, commercial aircraft, jet engines, chemicals, drugs. And you can kind of go on and on and on. The big difference, the big difference between now and 1980, though, is we're using fewer and fewer people to do it. The big changes have been in things like CAD-CAM, computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacturing, and in robotics. Number one, they have made manufacturing a heck of a lot more efficient, but it requires fewer and fewer people. And so we're making a heck of a lot more stuff than we were 35 years ago, but we don't need as many people to do it. And that's where the real kick comes in, because you don't have too many of those jobs anymore where people, you know, where you'd come out of high school and go to work, you know, in the steel mill like your dad did for 40 years. Those kind of jobs are almost gone. And that's the big difference. In terms of a housing bubble, I don't know that there is a housing bubble. All the statistics you look at today, and one came out this morning on the increase in home prices. Home prices, on average, across the United States, were right around $280,000, and the increase was about 2% over last year. So if you start looking at the increases in home prices, they're not near as drastic as the housing bubble that had occurred in 05 and 06. I don't think we have a bubble per se. I think we have a strong housing market. That's really good for the economy because about 18% of the total economy is construction.
Let's look at what in the few minutes that we have remaining, just how this impacts our region specifically. In Pittsburgh, funding for a great many things comes from endowments. If these endowments get hurt, how does that impact us?
Yeah, I would, you know what, I absolutely would agree with you. I'm a nonprofit board member myself, and I kind of see this up close and personal. And by the way, I also sat on the board, the Trustees Investment Committee at the University of Pittsburgh. I sat on the board there for 8 years, the board that oversees the endowment at the university. And one of the things that happens, obviously, is that if you are invested in the equity market at all, you know, your endowment and the value of your endowment is going to fluctuate. Some of that volatility is going to affect your investments. The flip side of that is if you've decided that you want to all be in fixed income, then if interest rates go up, then you get hurt badly. So I think what you have to do, and by the way, I've seen endowments that do this. I think certainly our endowment at the University of Pittsburgh is really good at this. You invest in a wide variety of things so that if one sector goes down, it's offset by another sector. And, you know, you're not trying to shoot for the moon. You're not trying to get the highest return there is. You're just trying to get a good, solid return while keeping in mind always that one of your primary goals is to protect your principal. And one of the things I think we have here in Pittsburgh, we have a lot of really good fund managers that manage these endowments. And I think they're very good at protecting the principal. And they're very good at diversifying across many different asset classes. So that's how you do it.
And how much more underfunded could the state of Pennsylvania potentially be as a result of this, especially if the diversified investing that you're saying smart investors like, according to you, the University of Pittsburgh are doing, you know, if the state isn't staying on top of this in the right way, what could the shortfall look like?
Yeah, I don't know because I don't track the state's pension. I used to track them. The state's pension funds were a client of mine many years ago. I really haven't tracked them very closely lately, but this is a problem. I'll tell you, it's very interesting because when you start thinking about the number of people that are affected by volatility, let's say in the stock market, who either have a defined benefit pension plan, like, you know, like the state's plan, like, you know, like a union pension plan or the state's plan or, you know, teachers' pension plans, or you also consider people who have IRAs and 401ks as their pension plans, you're looking at a vast number of people in our society. You're talking over 50% of the people in our society that in through some one of these vehicles, a pension plan or something, they own stock. And so when this happens, when this volatility happens, you know, it affects them in a big way.
And what about older people who are living off their investments?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. You would, you know, here's what I would suggest. You know, if you're living off investments right now, you know, you probably should not be in any kind of high volatility securities. There are things out there to invest in, like, you know, highly diversified fixed income mutual funds. On the other hand, let's say you're 35 or 40 years old. Then you should be able to take some risks. You should be able to invest in much riskier assets that are going to appreciate over time. And then what you have to be able to do in the short run is put up with the kind of volatility that you're going to experience. Because, you know, the fact is, and Paul, you I'm sure you know this, I'm sure listeners know this, in the long run, when you're talking 10-year periods of time, the place where you're going to earn the largest return, typically, and this goes back to when records have been started to be kept back in, you know, like 1906, the best returns have been in the stock market. In large cap stocks, over the long run, you're going to average about 10% per year in the long run. But you have to be able to understand that in the short run, there's going to be volatility. And just to put this in perspective, you know, we've had all this volatility lately in the last few days. But if you just go back to to July of 2009, at the depths of the stock market during the Great Recession, if you just go back to that period of time, and you would have invested, and you know, it was very difficult to invest at that point because everybody's stomachs were churning and nobody knew what was going to happen with the economy. But had you invested in the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average at that time, right now, even with this market falling apart in the last couple of weeks, you'd still have doubled your money since then.
Jay Sukitz is professor of business administration at the University of Pittsburgh's Katz Graduate School of Business. Jay, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
It's my pleasure, Paul.
Coming up, Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane will have to stand trial on charges she leaked grand jury information and lied about it to authorities. We'll talk with Dave Davies, who's covering the hearing. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.